So you see the topic up there. We're going to talk a little bit about modern programming languages, but I know I don't want to just tell you, oh, look, here's six really cool languages and here's how to program in them. I'm going to focus on, are people these days, when they develop new programming languages, do they care about the learner? Do they care to make the languages easy to learn, easy to understand, and so on? And one of the reasons I like to give this talk is that there's so many online coding schools popping up right now, and they're telling people almost that anybody can program, like it can't be that hard or anything like that, but this is certainly what they're trying to say. And if you've seen the movie Ratatouille, there was a line in there about a guy writing a book called Anyone Can Cook. And you go through the whole movie before they reveal what the meaning of that line is, anyone can cook. And it doesn't mean that anyone can cook without effort. It just means the good cooks can come from any background, anywhere, if they work hard enough at it. And programming is pretty much the same way. A good programmer can be anybody, but they have to work at it. They have to learn it. They have to understand it. So we're going to talk about what it means to learn and understand programming, and then again, whether modern languages are helping or not. Okay, I was asked to talk a little bit about me. So I got started at LMU in 1986. I'm going to be starting my 29th year there. It was a great place to work. Is that right, Catherine? It's a good place to work. So I started there, actually I started there as a student in 1981, graduated after 4 years, went to Europe with my girlfriend and another friend and went from country to country. Missed Greece though, but did get to Hungary and East Germany and Italy and all those, you know, places in the center. And came back after turning down a lot of jobs and said, oh man, what am I going to do? So I went to Phil Doran, who's still there. He was a teacher of mine there, and said, master's program, that pretty good? He says, oh, yeah, just take a year. Just get started with the classes, and then we'll sign you up. So I got my master's there and started teaching the next year. And then ended up at UCLA after a year or so when they said, you're not going to get tenure unless you have a PhD. So I said, okay, count me in. But I had already had a house. I'd already gotten married by that time. So UCLA or USC or UCSD were like the only choices. Rich Korf, who's going to talk next month, he was one of my professors over there at UCLA. That guy's great. I probably can't give a talk half as well as he can, so you'll have something to look forward to. He's really good. And I graduated there in 1993. I just stayed at LMU through the whole time. My background's in programming languages mostly, but at LMU, because it's a liberal arts school, we have to teach just about everything, so I've taught everything. If you Google me and you look at my list of courses, they're pretty much all there. I think I've taught about 16 or 17 different courses in the 28 years. But it's fun. A liberal arts school is a great place to get a technical degree. I know a lot of people these days say, well, I'm not going to send my kid to a liberal arts school for a technical degree. They need to go to MIT. They need to go to Caltech. That's probably not true for an undergraduate degree. What you do get at the big schools, though, is you get connections. If you want to make a big splash in the world, or you want to be on, if you want to design self-driving cars as an undergrad, yeah, okay, that's what you can get from a Caltech or an MIT. But you can also do that as in grad school, too, at a big school. So we work really hard at LMU on our culture. I've seen at least three people just in the last year who have told me, oh man, if I would have found out about computer science, I would have been a computer science major. Why did I not know about this field? Why was I not in computer science? We have a lot of people that aren't even computer science majors like to hang out in our laboratory. The program at LMU has been around since 1982. It was started by a colleague of mine, Phil Doran, who was originally at MIT. He started teaching at LMU in 1971. He's still there, as am I, and I got another buddy who started a few years after me. This is a good field to get into if you want to just stick with one company. I have so many friends that have, you know, they've got 10, 15 jobs by the time they're in their 50s, like me. All right, so at LMU we have, it's a traditional computer science curriculum. Students are active in international programming contests. They have a lab which is decked out with all kinds of great stuff. And the philosophy that we have at LMU for computer science teaching is that
Programmers right now can program anything. So it's not just desktops or laptops, but the kids actively program robots, they program drones, they program cell phones and tablets and things like that. Because computing as a computing science is really about getting things to do what you want them to do. And there's so many different platforms for computing right now. And that makes the field really fun. Don't think I have to go over all the great things you could do with a computer science degree, but we do try and give the kids at LMU a great chance for that. And our graduates do go to Google and Apple, you know, as well as some of the local companies. And it's a really, really fun, really, really fun major. We have a good department, I think, there. All right, so anything else you want to know about me or LMU? Computer science? That's good. Well, that went actually kind of fast. Okay, because I don't want to finish, you know, by 8 o'clock and then you have a break and the talk's all done. All right, I'll just go on then. So are we good? Any more about me? I live in Glendale, 3 kids, 51, born in Detroit, 1963, moved out in 66 before the city kind of got bad. Yes? Oh, thanks for that. Thanks for that. No, I guess my one wish is that I could convince my kids to go there. I got one, my oldest graduated from Wellesley College, but she wanted to do astrophysics and LMU doesn't have an observatory. So she double majored in poli-sci. And I go, well, Wellesley has a little bit more cred for poli-sci. Yeah, okay, that's fine, you can go there. But if it was just computer science, it would have been a different story. Yes, Maurice. No, LMU only gives doctorates in education. So LMU is considered a regional school. It's considered a master's level. There's a lot of departments with master's degrees, but no PhDs. LMU is world class in debate, probably film and television, and LMU in engineering is considered really good, but it's the kind of school nobody knows about because you tend not to associate liberal arts colleges with the technical fields. But we kind of use that to our advantage. You know, on the one hand, the kids are getting plenty of humanities and arts and communications classes part of their core because that's what liberal arts institutions do. So we feel like we're able to graduate, you know, good technically capable engineers, but that also have good communication skills, understand the arts, know a little bit of the common cultures and other people's cultures and how the world works and stuff like that. I like these mid-range schools. I really thought about teaching other places, but I think I'm a lifer, probably luckily. I'm glad to be there. Okay. All right, so on to the talk. I don't know how many of you guys follow Michael Bloomberg on Twitter. I don't follow him on Twitter, but this tweet was really interesting and caused a lot of people to comment on it. He said at the beginning of 2012 that, oh yeah, my goal is to learn how to program. I think the Codecademy and Code School and all these other places really started getting really big around 2012. 2011, 2012, they all launched. And I can see why, because if you might remember when I graduated in 1985 with computer science, there were a lot of computer science graduates. And what a lot of people don't know is about 36% of them were female at the time, computer science graduates. Something happened between 1984, 1985, so 2007. Not only did the number of graduates in computer science absolutely tank, completely crater, there were like half as many graduates in the mid-2000s as there were in the 1980s in computer science, at least in the U.S. And the number of female graduates also went way down into, almost fell into the single digits, I think it was somewhere between 11 and 15%. And people rightly started talking about this. This is a problem. I mean, we have so many jobs, we can't fill them. We have to get more women into STEM. I mean, not just computer science, although it's bad enough. You know, there are a lot of factors to this thing. People will debate the social factors all the time. I mean, part of it, of course, was bad role models and negative portrayals of computer programmers in the movies. You've all heard those things, probably. And people started in the late 2000s in the previous decade started really saying, hey, we got to get more people to program, we got to get more people to program. And, of course, you know, Michael Bloomberg jumped on, and he got a lot of blowback on this. And a good quote from a guy named Jeff Atwood, who said, oh, it's a noble gesture, of course, but if he really needs to sling some JavaScript code, there's something horribly wrong with the city of New York. And if you don't mind me reading a little bit more about what he said, he wrote, "Fortunately, the odds of this technological flight of fancy happening, even in jest, are zero. And for a good reason. The mayor of New York City will hopefully spend his time doing his job taxpayers paid him to do instead. According to the Office of the Mayor homepage, this means working on absenteeism programs for schools, public transport improvements, the 2013 city budget, and do I really need to go on? Will coding help him in his job? No, I mean, so the guy, I mean, and this guy's a programmer, you know, he loves programming, he says he loves programming, and yes, there is benefit in computational thinking. It helps you in your daily life and so on and so on. But do you need to understand recursion, variables, pointers, functions, all the stuff these coding schools are really trying to teach? And the answer is probably no. But it was, again, in response to a real need to get more people interested, at least in coding, and to fill all these jobs which are not being filled. So here are a list of companies that will try to teach you how to code. And I've known that in the last few years, they are getting a little bit better. I mean, certainly their user interfaces are getting better. They look a lot more fun. But they're trying. You heard of any of these? You probably heard of Khan Academy. Khan Academy is not just teaching programming. Sal Khan is trying to teach just about everything. But they do have a computer science section. There is Khan Academy Computer Science, which is now called Khan Academy Computer Programming. I noticed that they changed it since they launched. I think somebody kind of caught on that computer science is an academic discipline where you study information and information theory and syntax and semantics and grammars and communication and, you know, distribution and all this kind of stuff. We're not really just programming. Anyway, so many of these companies trying to teach you how to code. Will they teach everybody? One advantage they have is that, well, programming's not as hard as it used to be. You might remember, these are a couple of the initial original programmers, and do you recognize the machine? What's the machine that they're programming on? It's closed. Yeah. It's the ENIAC. The ENIAC, E-N-I-A-C, right? That's the first computer that was considered to be both electromechanical and general purpose. Before the ENIAC, there were electromechanical computers, but they weren't general purpose. There were general purpose computers, which were not based on electricity and things like that. That's now the ENIAC. And you can read about the story of the first programmers of the ENIAC. It's called, like, the ENIAC Programmers Project. You can read all about their story. It's very, very interesting. There were six of them. They did all that programming. And even though it was a general-purpose computer, it was pretty much, you know, computing missile trajectories and things like that. But where was the ENIAC located? I don't even know. I'm guessing, who knows? Oh, which one is she? Ready? Okay. Oh, that's cool. ENIAC was located in New York. Oh. Sure. Yeah, it took so many years for them to kind of get recognition of what they did, yeah. IBM was probably related. It was a U.S. government project. Now, these are all, these photos. I was supposed to use this photo. I probably should have tagged it, you know, copyright U.S. Army photo, use with permission or something, but I don't even know. Maybe I should have muted that. This is 1946, I think. This is about 46, 47 is when this picture was taken. Okay. All right, and I used to memorize the names of the six computers. There was one named Betty. What was her first name again? Evo. Okay. Oh, nice. All right. And one of the ENIAC programmers. Okay, so that makes my ENIAC programmer number 3 now is this one. Or 2. No, I'm a 2. It's 0-1. You're in direct contact. They're very cool. All right. Well, you can see here that, well, programming used to be, let's wire things up so the data goes from here to here. But programming was about to change shortly after. This is who? This is Grace Hopper. Grace Hopper's idea is that programming should be easy for people, that we don't care so much about the numbers that trigger additions, multiplications, subtractions, and everything like that. Words like add, ADD, or multiply, or whatever might actually be easier for people. And she generated a quote. I don't know where this quote is from, but I found the quote on the Grace Hopper Wiki Quotes page, and it says, this is said about her, but nobody knows who really said it. So it says, Grace, then anyone will be able to write programs. I'm sure she was like, well, fine, well, like, isn't that the goal? That's so funny to hear stuff like that now, because out of all the fields, one thing I really like about working with other programmers is I don't know any programmer, I don't personally, maybe somebody else does, who doesn't want to take what they've written and just post it on the internet or on GitHub or something for everybody to see. I mean, programming, there's something about some connection between your love of creating software that actually does something and then your willingness to just share it and give it away. It's true that people make money writing software that helps a company do what the company needs to do. And that's not general purpose fun software. That's something for a particular company. And people are rightly paid for that kind of stuff. But whenever somebody writes code to help people manage their daily habits, to write memos, to do their word processing, to reserve flights, whatever they want to do. I mean, that's stuff people love to give away. People like to write games and give them away. Not really the big, big, big games. You know, those are on subscription and those can make a ton of money. But for the most part, people love sharing. You get more benefit from, hey, look, I wrote this. You go to get a job. Oh, let's look at your online portfolio. What have you written? Oh, you wrote that particular game? Yeah, you're hired. You know, people do that, you know, to help their standing. And that's a good thing. But the field didn't start off that way. You know, the field started off like, we can write code and no one else can do it. This is like our secret, you know, kind of a thing. And Grace Hopper did a lot to change that way of thinking. She got a lot more people involved and, I mean, she's not the only person, obviously, but she did write the first compiler. Right? She's known for that. Compiler is a program that translates the English-like or Spanish-like or Russian-like or Greek-like code into something a computer can understand. Anybody know what programming language she ended up creating as well? COBOL, right? It's very English-like, though. I mean, people that have never seen COBOL before, you know. It's hard to say, right? I mean, COBOL has lines like, you know, move Y plus 3 into X or something. You write it out. Everyone else is like, oh, I'm with the equal signs and stuff. But anyway, it generates a little bit of a debate. You know, what's good. But hey, give her credit. This is the 1950s, right? The funny thing about the 1950s programming languages was that you had COBOL, which is really wordy, Fortran, which still has some use today, and Lisp, which is dearly loved by a lot of people even today. I mean, there's people that think that Lisp probably is the language done right. So anyone can program, right? Then why do we have this? Why? How are you going to select in the upper left-hand corner? Okay, great. What year do you want to select? You're stuck, aren't you? Look at the bottom left. Oh, here's a function called email list. I don't see an email list there. How does this stuff get into real production code? You try to return true? Oh, like that's going to fail? It's like if I can't return true, then I'm going to try and return. What's going on? Right? And what's wrong over here? That doesn't work. Look at the exchange rates over there on the right-hand side. I don't know if you can't read it. Way over on the right-hand side it says the exchange rate infinity percent. Not just infinity percent, plus infinity percent. So you got that's important, so it's not negative infinity percent. How do you get this kind of stuff if anyone can program? Oh, sure, it's easy. We're going to teach you how to program, so you'll never be able to write this. Oh, it can't be that hard. Might be hard to see what's in the upper left, but you know, see where Honolulu is? Oh, that's really hard to see. That's actually Australia. It's kind of hard to picture there. But Honolulu is right there where you'd expect to see Brisbane or Melbourne. That's Honolulu. And hey, congratulations! You won String Not Found. Question 1 of NaN. Anyone know what NaN is? By the way, how did that NaN get there? See if there's any programmers out here. I'm pointing in the lower right. I'm going clockwise. Lower right, NaN. What's NaN? NaN stands for not a number. It's a number. A lot of programming languages. And this is the part about programming that is hard to get people to understand. Divide zero by zero, what do you get? I don't know. Should your program crash? Is it zero? Is it one? Is it infinite? No, so they invented this thing called NaN. Electrical engineers invented NaN. There's just particular bit patterns that say, well, it's not a number. You know? But it gets in there somehow. If it gets into the program, as does undefined. Undefined means, well, I don't know, something's wrong. You tried to print out the wrong thing, so it's not even there, it's undefined. One of my favorites is over here. License key expires in the top of the pop-up, and license key expires. You got the exact same words, you know, entitling that. That's redundant. I probably should say days remaining, but it says remains days. Is that this? Okay. Well, you'd expect to see in the little calendar. Did anybody ever like the fact when you had spiral notebooks and lined paper and all those fancy little things that look like stuff that should appear on your desk on your computer screen? What's that called? There's actually a word. What? Oh, there's a word. Skeuomorphism, right? Yeah, the idea that we should take things from your world and we should actually put them on the screen. Anyway, they tried to... Apparently, if there were 17 days remaining, there would be a 1. And then there would be a 7. But now we got an accented E and we got a left paren. Not too helpful. You have a license key number. That's suspicious. It says 000000. I think that was the missile launch codes too during the Cold War. 000000. Fun fact for the day. Activation date. Okay, January 1st, 1970. You're a programmer, you probably know that. That date has significance. Time usually starts on January 1st, 1970 at midnight in English time, GMT. So obviously somebody did something wrong. And then I like how there's an HTTP on the bottom. What's going on? Okay, these look like just minor mistakes, right? Just minor mistakes? Anybody could do it. Anybody can make a typo, right? Yeah, well... There's also mistakes where people just have no concept what they're doing. What's a Boolean? True, false, and file not found? Who comes up with this kind of stuff? Yeah. Oh, that's what it was. Okay, true, false. Yeah, and the ternary logic, right? And then down at the bottom, this is something I just threw up here for fun. I'm not expecting you to know what it means, but this is a little scripting language that controls all the Unix computers. It's known as Bash or SH. Some people might know it, some people might not, but what the programmer did over here is they're trying to write a little script that, you know, you give this particular bit of information, we're going to install a program for you. And the parameters that are given to this little script for installation in this language are $1, $2, $3, $4, which is not very learnable. Or is that good or bad? I mean, don't you think, those of you that have programmed before, you tend to use names for things. Why $1? But anyway, the fun part of it is, in this particular language, if the parameters are missing, they just come out as blanks, just completely empty. So this little program here, cause a bit of fun. Without a second and third parameter, what you get for the first line is RM minus RF and just a slash. Just a slash. Some of you might know what that means. If you get down to your terminal window in your Mac or Unix or something, RM is remove. Minus R is recursive, which means remove everything in this directory and the directories below it and the directories below that and the directories below that. The F stands for force, which means don't ask me if I really want to do this. It means do it anyway. And RM minus RF with a slash deletes every file on your system. And if these installation scripts are run with root permission, as they often are, that's a complete wipeout of everything that happens. So the people making these mistakes, sure, some are typos. Everybody makes typos. But sometimes people are really just, they just really don't understand what they're doing. They don't understand. Why is file not found? Well, I mean, what are they doing there? Sorry about that. I should turn this off or something. Is this better? Okay. I'll try not to, whatever made that happen. We need to ask how to get people to understand programming, because a lot of problems are made with people not really understanding what it is that they're doing. These mistakes are, they come from the language. So there is a guy that actually seems to have a really good answer for how we get people to understand programming. His name is Brett Victor. He's worked at many places. He's worked at Apple. I'd really encourage you to just look him up. Again, Brett Victor, he has a nice site where he's written many, many essays, and he's done many, many things, primarily at Apple, where he was responsible for a lot of user interface design. And he's also very interested in getting people how to learn, as are people like Alan Kay. Anyone heard of Alan Kay? Alan Kay, he has a little institute in Glendale, Viewpoints Institute, where he's... They're very, very interested in K-12 education, stuff like that. I mean, there are people who really care passionately about not just how do we write something that's cool and technical, but programming is for people. Programming is for people, and how do we get them to understand? This essay is just fabulous. Written in about 2012, it's called Learnable Programming. And it's probably an hour well spent to read it over, if you have background in programming. If you don't have background in programming, it might not be as interesting, but I'll show you a few snippets from it and a few things that he said that are hopefully, you know, good for a general audience. But he's really trying to answer the question, how do we make programming understandable by people? And this essay, it's changed the way I looked at teaching, at least teaching the freshmen. It made an impact on me. And there are things that would be probably fun sharing. And his part of his answer is to change programming by turning it into something understandable by people. And that's kind of what Grace Hopper was doing back in the 50s, right? I mean, nobody understands 10001111001001. You don't. You make it a little bit more understandable. And I'm sure the people that first wrote assembly language thought that they had just completely changed everything. In fact, the first compilers, they were called automatic programming. It was called automatic programming. That was the word they used it. Because what's going to happen is you write down a little bit of English language text, and automatically the computer's going to turn it into a real program. So you weren't really programming. Assembly language programming wasn't programming. Have you heard that one before? Oh, that language, that's not really programming. Real programmers do it like this. Real programmers look over hex dumps and spill their coffee on it and all that stuff. Those aren't really funny anymore, but that was the humor in the 50s and 60s. And I should say it's not funny because we don't have the context anymore. Programmers just expect something at a high level. Yeah. That would be considered a very high-level language, yes. That's right. Yeah, the compiler is the translator that turns something English or English-like into machine language. Machine language is a string of ones and zeros that, when put into the computer a certain way and goes through all the circuitry, causes additions and movement of data and other operations to happen. That's the machine language. That's how people used to do it. I mean, it used to be very physical, right? The picture we saw earlier, people were actually connecting things together physically. Then later it would be punch cards, which would have the instructions with the ones and the zeros and certain things punched out so that they would work. That's programming. But programming today is a little more fun. If there's time and you want to see how people program today, I'll just bring up a browser and knock out some things. It can be very, very fun. So I know the LA Computer Society has founded around the time personal computers became popular. Didn't I hear something about users helping users and personal computer enthusiasts was part of the website? And one of the things that made the personal computers so fun when they came out, at least the IBM PC, it had this little basic interpreter in it. anybody could take the thing out of the box and just start typing in code. You didn't have to download a C compiler, a Fortran compiler. You just started right in the basic, you know? And that got people interested in programming. We do have a language, like, and BASIC kind of fell out of favor for a bit, or actually, I don't know if it fell out of favor, but I know Microsoft took it over and created Visual BASIC out of it, but then you had to download all this stuff, and it was had all these windows and stuff, and all of a sudden programming became really, really way more complicated than it used to be. So another language took its place starting about the late 90s. The program, the thing that anybody that picks up a computer can just start typing in a program. It's not BASIC. What language is that, by the way? Anyone know? Anybody can start writing a program in what language, even though they don't do anything. If you buy a computer and you take it home, whether I don't care if it's a PC or a Mac, there is a language that you can start programming in without downloading anything. It starts, well, in you can do Bash if it's a Mac, or you can do the batch programming or probably PowerShell in the new PCs. But there's one that's even more fun. You can bring up a browser, open up its developer tools, and start writing or JavaScript. Yeah. JavaScript. So JavaScript took over in the late 1900s. It's the most popular programming language in the world by most measures. Okay, so everybody can do it. And that's kind of fun. The designer of JavaScript tried to make it really understandable to people, and he did a lot of things which made people with very little programming experience get flaming logos up on the screen and making their stuff move around on web pages, you know, without any programming experience. But for the first few years, a lot of people looked at JavaScript and said, what? This is a toy piece of crap. And then in 2001, people said, wait a minute, it's only 80% of the language that's crap, but there's 20% in here, which is really sophisticated and really good. Now JavaScript is understood to be a very, very powerful and useful programming language. Is it understandable by people? To some extent. But if this guy Brett Victor is going to make a claim that we can make programming understandable by people, he better back it up. Why did he even talk about learnable programming? There's an interesting story behind here I think you might find interesting. If you really want to be inspired, watch, there's an online talk by Brett Victor called Inventing on Principle. Just Google it. Just watch it. He begins his talk by saying, today I'm going to tell you how to live your life. You know, so even though it's at a technical conference. And his idea was that you as a person, should have a principle that informs everything you do. For Brett Victor, his principle was to enable people to be creative. So he wanted creators to have immediate feedback on what they did. So one thing he did in the video, but I can't do the video justice. You have to see it. It's pretty phenomenal, especially for 2011 when it came out. He showed that with a split screen, as you type on the left-hand side, everything shows up immediately on the right. And you could tweak some numbers, and you could hit a number and move it around there, and then the sun in your drawing would go up and down, or the tree would get bigger and have more branches. And then he changed some other numbers, and there were some completely unexpected things happen, like the tree would split up in a whole bunch of different things. I never would have thought of that. And for those of you that are interested just in the whole idea of science, you know that science is driven by, well, there used to be called two pillars of scientific discovery, right? There was theory and there was experimentation. Now it's well understood that there's a third pillar called computation, because now that we can speed things up quadrillions of times faster than we ever could before, we're now able to understand things that we never could have before. We're able to explore all possible ways a protein can fold, and then we can make mistakes and change things around, and then, you know how they say in science that the best thing to say as a scientist isn't, aha, I've got it, but rather, oh, that's funny. You know? So this computation has opened up all of these, that's funny, moments. And there are so many things. I mean, it's really even just changed the way we think about doing science. That's because we can speed things up. So Brett Victor's principle, he says in the video, and again, I can't recommend it enough, is that I want to have, in order for people to create, they have to have immediate feedback to what it is that they're creating. He did this through what's called the live coding environment. As you type your code, you immediately see the effects. You can kind of touch the code and move it around. He's got some ways to do animations with his hands and create things that are still look like, I mean, they look like just pipe dreams or something, but he built these things. You know, he's that good. So an interesting thing about this thing, a brilliant talk. I mean, it's got millions of views on Vimeo. And he even mentions that when you do this, when you live your life by principle, and I'm doing this for technology, but you know what, he compares what he's doing to people like Elizabeth Cody Stanton. You know, when you see a wrong in the world and you try to right it, he saw a wrong in the world. Like, creators can't create. So he says it's almost like a moral thing to do. He's talking about technology with using moral language, which actually works. It's actually kind of, it's very, very fun to see. But the funniest thing happened about this talk is the people at Khan Academy saw his live coding environment, and they said, this is just what we need to teach people to understand programming. But they totally missed the point. He was talking about, I'm trying to help people create. I'm not talking about learning. Khan Academy implemented his stuff and implemented it, let me skip ahead one slide, implemented it incorrectly. They took all of his work. They took the JavaScript programming language, the processing programming language, put the things together and said, we're going to teach you how to program like this, using his platform for artists to create things. And he said, oh, this live coding environment addresses neither of these goals for learning how to program. They support weak ways of thinking or decades of learning about learning. Decades of learning about learning, right? Live coding is worthless. So let me go back. So somebody took something that had nothing to do with learning and tried to teach off of it. And he was inspired by that to say, you know what I need to do? I need to talk about what it really means to make programming learnable and understandable by people. All right? So to back it up, okay, in this essay, he says that systems that are going to help you learn should support and encourage powerful ways of thinking and allow people to, you know, immediately see and understand what it is that their code is doing. Why is learning kind of a problem? This may be hard to see, so I'll read the bottom over here. This is taken directly from his talk. He says, okay, you're trying to teach people how to learn. Khan Academy has decided to teach people to draw pictures using this programming language. The first line says, fill 161.219.114. First question a learner may ask, what does fill mean? And then another one, what do these numbers after fill mean? Do you know what they mean? Should you guess? Khan Academy's approach to teaching computer science at the time was, put your mouse on them, slide it over, watch the numbers go up or down, watch the effect over there, and guess what it is. Is that how you would teach? Hope not. I mean, Brett Victor uses in the talk, is that would be like if you got a microwave oven out of the box and it said, press this button to see what it does, and guess what it does. Slide this thing over, guess what it does. Not helpful. What about these numbers after ellipse? And then here's some more questions. Do these numbers all mean the same thing? What units are they in? What ranges do they have? And then in the small print in the bottom right, why are there so many numbers? Ask a lot of people why they never got into programming. Oh, it's all those numbers. I'm not good at math. Programming is about language. It's a much better analog to what it is that programming, putting together a program is. It's very much like language. I don't mean language like poetry, you know, or something like that, but these are linguistic structures, which now, if you're a mathematician and you object to that statement, fine, because then I would say, well, language is just another, is very mathematical itself. Okay. But I'm talking about programming not being as mathematical as people think, I'm using the popular term of math as being numbers. So these are pretty important questions to ask that a learner may ask. So we'll break after this slide, and then we'll talk about the languages after the break. So Brett Victor's done some research, and in his research he says, to learn programming, you should have a system that supports in the environment somewhere. The environment is the part that, you know, helps you with your programming. Learners should be able to not have to go to a book, a separate manual, to find out how to do things. On the screen, you should, I don't know, put your mouse or your finger over the word fill and have a little description right then and there. You should be able to follow the flow. As your code is running, you should be able to see it run, and you should see the effects of the running thing back to where your code is. What part of my code made that happen? Right? We tend to think of, because of the way programming started with electromechanical machines, you know, back in the day, you know, we still use the same patterns. Why do we have keyboards and look at a screen? Because people had typewriters and printers. They had teletypes. Why are we still tied to that? Why aren't we? I mean, still today, people program with keyboards and things, and then they write the program. Then you download them to your phone or your pads or something, right? Because we don't have a good sense yet of doing it. And all attempts to, like, dictate your program, and they're hard problems. But we're really tied to some of these old ways of doing things. We should be able to see the state. Probably the most important thing. Is anybody interested in what's called the visualization of information? You know, like Edward Tufte. Edward Tufte, he's considered a guru in this, like how information should be displayed and how's it communicated. He's all about information. All he cares about the people, how they digest information. His golden rule is what? See the state. Right? There actually is, there's a way, you know what? There is a way of programming other than, for those of you that program, how many, what are your favorite languages? What do you think when you think of program? What do you code in? Let's see. Pascal? Pascal's fine. Fortran, Pascal, Fortran. C, Java, Basic, okay. LV, what? Jovial, yeah, precursor to Ada. Yeah, I totally remember. XAC, yeah, okay. All these languages you're talking about, what do? You type it in, you compile it, and it runs. Where's the connection between, there's no connection. What do you see? You see the code. Do you ever see the data? Or do you see the code? You see the code, you run it, it produces data. Yep. That's right. That's it. That's right. Visual debuggers, for those people that use them, and not everybody does, get very close to the idea of learning this way. But there's even something else that's even one step even beyond the visual debugger, which is considered a good way to program. Talk about people that haven't programmed much. They can use spreadsheets. And with just a little bit of training, not too much training, they can start filling in basic little formulas inside the cells. But you know what? You know how spreadsheet programming? It's just like conventional programming, completely different. With a spreadsheet, you see the data, the code, the one that's hidden that you kind of have to dig in for. Whereas, you know, with the conventional code, you start with the code and you kind of dig in there. And there's a lot of people that say that, you know, there's something that they have with spreadsheets. Now, not every piece of data fits into a spreadsheet model, so. But it would be interesting, but people, I'm sure, are researching the problem of how to get much highly more structured data where a spreadsheet would be right now. We can code on that. Okay. Learners like to start with a little bit of code and kind of manipulate it into other things. It's like, you know, when you're drawing, well, here's a triangle. I need another triangle, you know, copy, bring it over, square, make it a little bit bigger. A visual debugger, it actually doesn't shape your triangles, but you can kind of get close, but you're going to have to work at the numbers. It's almost better to work visually. Anyway, the three things under the E's have to do with environmental support. I know it's almost 8. I'll stop after these. But there are 4 things that a language could do, 4 principles that a learnable programming language should have in, and that's what we're going to get to in the second half of the talk. Language should be metaphor-based, and it should really help you decompose your thoughts and glue them back together. We're going to see examples of where that fails. Languages in which you paste a little piece of code over here and just changed everything. People that say that's just the way programming works aren't thinking hard enough, you know. Every time you see something that doesn't work the way you expect, what should your attitude be? Why isn't it working the way I expect? And don't stop and say, well, this is just because it's the way it is. You know, if Brett Victor would have you say, well, think of it as a wrong. maybe it's just an accident of history that it works that way. Maybe there's a better way to do it. And if you go try to fix the wrong, you may come up with a better way to do things. And finally, know what the code means just by reading. This is why people don't program in machine language. 1-1-0, you don't know what it means. You might not even know what add means. Some languages are pretty good at being readable, but there are ways to improve the readability of code a great deal. I mean, like this example over here, this is a horrible, this fails horribly at being readable. Because fill, you would think, doesn't fill sound like a verb? Fill something, fill right here, fill it in. No, that's just setting a fill color for later. And why are ellipse and rect not called draw ellipse and draw rectangle? Why not? It's a mistake. They should not have written their code that way. All right, so quick review. Brett Victor mentioned 9 principles that a system for learning should try to follow. 5 were environmental. 4 were based on the language. This talk is about languages, so let's talk about what languages can do for the learner. Before I talk about modern languages, I want to highlight the 4 languages and systems that Brett Victor highlighted in his talk, because he said these things did it right. We heard earlier before the break that visual debuggers give us a good connection between code and their responses, allow you to see the flow, see the state, and they do a good job. They're sort of ancillary to the language, though. You know, you run the language, then you have a debugger. It's kind of environmental. But there are languages themselves that actually support learning in a way. I don't know if you can... you might remember that. You know what that kid has in the upper left? You know what that thing is? It's a little plastic thing. It's got wheels, and it's got a lot of circuitry and semiconductors. The thing's called a turtle. And the language that they program those turtles in is Logo. And if you were to Google Logo Turtle video, you know, this part of this video that's has Seymour Papert in there, author of Mindstorms, which is one of the most influential books on learning probably ever written. These kids would program a turtle to move around. And what they would do is they would act it out. I mean, their way of thinking was, you know, walk forward 3 spaces, turn a certain number of degrees, and walk forward. There's a very strong metaphor when you do Logo programming. You draw by giving instructions to a turtle, but the instructions are very physical. You can act it out. And I know that probably anybody interested in psychology probably has heard about how humans themselves kind of go through stages of learning. And I don't know if you've heard this story. I don't know who tells this story. Alan Kay mentioned it one time, which was taking the programming language Logo and getting people to program with it, people that really hadn't programmed before. 5-year-olds, there was a 5-year-old, a 10-year-old, a 15-year-old. The 5-year-old took to the task very easily and drew a perfect circle because the 5-year-old's understanding of drawing a circle was very physical. The 5-year-old knew how to walk around in a circle and was able to instruct the turtle, move, turn, move, turn, move, turn. Because when you're about till you're 5, learning is physical. It's tactile. It starts becoming a little more, what would the word be? After the physical, there's this, maybe visual, right? And there are a 10-year-old trying to program the turtle to move in a circle. And the 10-year-old had been exposed to those compasses in school. And his connection to the compass was the endpoint here in the middle here. And for some reason, that kid's idea of the program was to set the turtle down to make a mark, go to the middle, go back out while it wasn't drawing, and draw another point. Go back to the middle, draw another point. Go back to the middle, draw another point. And got a circle with a bunch of points there because he was in that 10-year-old visual learning area. The 15-year-old's understanding of circles was x squared plus y squared equals r squared and never drew a thing. So, I don't know. This isn't a talk. I mean, Sir Ken Robinson could give the talk on all those things like that. But the interesting thing about that is, you know, when they asked some of the scientists that made discoveries, you know, into their later years, like Albert Einstein always said that when he was encountered a formula or something, he actually felt it, you know. Some people say they see it. okay, well, I see the effects of the formula. And Einstein and others like him would say, oh, I know, just feel it. You know, I know what all the forms mean. I can have a sense of what all the variables are doing. I mean, no one who's really excelled as a great scientist just works totally on the symbolic level. You know, the trick is to drop down to a lower level. And that's why languages like Logo and these languages that have direct drawing, not by saying fill and rect and things like that, but rather that do the drawing physically, work better for learners. HyperCard, I guess. I mean, you've had to have played with the Mac computer back in the early PC days. HyperCard was a programming language, like very English-like. And even if you think you hate COBOL, take a look at HyperCard. Just Google it and see what it looks like. It's not bad. It's very old, but it had a strong metaphor. Programming was a stack of cards. Small talk. Who would have heard of small talk? That's the language that came out of Xerox in the 70s and 80s. This was created by the same team which brought us the window with the menu, all the little icons, the little pointer that moved across, the idea that you could pull down a menu, context menus, windows overlapping. That all came from Smalltalk. Smalltalk brought us the notion of an object. And objects are good to program with because they're so self-contained. Circles have a center point and a radius, but they can draw themselves, they can fill themselves in, they have a color, they can rotate, they can do things. Or a house has particular properties in size, and it can have its doors open or its windows open. The idea that programming is all based on things, and you send messages to things to have them do things, and they're so self-contained that you don't move it to another part of the program and then all of a sudden have it work improperly, because of this idea of cohesiveness and self-contained. That's what Smalltalk brought and helped learners. Yes. Yeah, the star, the alto, and Steve Jobs was so impressed by Smalltalk and all those Xerox machines that inspired him to build the very first personal computer with all these fancy things on it, which was called the... Well, that's the graphical user interface. But what machine did Steve Jobs build, which was influenced by Smalltalk, the first personal computer, which had Windows and used a mouse, had a little icon. The Lisa, yes. And why didn't a lot of people buy the Lisa? Cost. So you made a low-cost version of the Lisa called the Macintosh. Yeah. The Mac was different. The Apple II was still, if anyone have an Apple II, you brought it up and you typed. It was still console with typing. And you could have line-drawn graphics to play games on it, but no, the Mac had the Windows and things. And then, that's called Rocky's Boots. Somebody there is, within Rocky's Boots, somebody's making, you can make electronic circuits and all sort of fun things with it, like you can in Smalltalk. But who's making all those things is the little character Rocky. So by identifying strongly with the character Rocky, moving Rocky around, to put things together, you're doing programming in a different way. Those are very, very old systems, but they're actually able to work. Why did they work? They worked because there was a metaphor, and all of the elements in there, like the HyperCard cards, the logo turtle, Rocky's Boots Rocky character, Smalltalk's objects, could always be broken down into smaller and smaller objects. Objects break into smaller and smaller objects. Think of an airplane, has wings and a fuselage and a tail, and it has windows, multiple copies of windows. When you think about them all as separate things, irrespective of everything else, you know, then your mind's not cluttered with how they're all related to each other. Get the individual objects working perfectly. Okay, they're very cohesive. They do everything they're supposed to do. You might have heard that before, right? Do one thing and do it right. Okay? And then someone else does one thing and does the one thing right. And find the minimal way for them to talk to each other. And that's how you wire the system together. That's how we as humans deal with massive complexity. How come people like us that aren't even very smart and make mistakes constantly can make something like a very reliable internet? Do you know how many quadrillions, septillions of bytes are flowing back and forth every day and hardly any of them are wrong? And when they are wrong, there's error-correcting mechanisms to fix it. The underlying hardware over which all the electrons flow and the packets flow back and forth within the global internet, huge error rates. They're terrible. But their software in there says, you didn't get my packet, resend it. Didn't get it, resend it. We've built a very reliable system over a highly unreliable infrastructure. Okay? Because we know how to do that, because we can break up. Let's look at the process of getting a packet from here to here. Okay? Don't just worry about the one packet. Think about it at a higher level. How am I going to get data from here to here? Not how am I going to get a packet from here to here? Because you're going to send the packet and you're not going to get a response. So you try it again. And you have and then you don't try an infinite number of times. You know, you set things like, well, time to live. Give up after 255 tries or something like that. Humans can build things of great complexity because of our ability to decompose things. And if you can decompose things into things that look like the higher level thing, you can put them back together. I mean, things make sense to you that way. And then you can compose them the same way. Right? I mean, if I build I can build an adder that just works. I can build a multiplier that just works. And then I can build something that can add and multiply. Like I can figure out if two things are perpendicular or something like that. Or I can build something that knows how to... Well, I should stop using numbers as an example, right? Because this is all the people that don't like numbers. But, I can just build a little component of my program that knows how to hyphenate. And one that knows how to break at the end of a line, and a little piece that knows how to respond to a character being typed, and I can do a little bit of logic that helps me paginate, right? And a little bit to justify things so they don't go too far. You know, I can put all those little tiny things together, which I can think about independently and make a really complicated word processor. But you have to think that way. And if you just start people programming by saying, oh, here, write some C code that, you know, write some multiplication table or something together, and you teach them nothing about how it's made up of little things that work together, they're not going to learn. All these systems are really good at decomposition and then composition. They don't, oh, yeah. Yeah, that's, I'm there right now. And then there's this idea of state being minimized. State is a term that refers to what you know in the world right now. It's like I guess the best example is state of mind. Hey, what's your state of mind? Okay, it's all that, everything you're feeling right now, everything you're thinking. Okay, so what state are you in? Yeah. Okay, well, I'm happy, I'm unhappy, I'm this or that. So state would be the values of all, if to use a programming analogy, state is the value of all the variables at a given time. The turtle is here, it's pointing this way, and its pen that it's drawing with is actually up at the moment. And then if I move it, then the state is, okay, now the state is, it's here, the pen is down, and now it's facing this angle. So that's the idea of state. State is the values of the computation at a given time. Again, to use a computer analogy. All you need to know to draw pictures in Logo is a very small state. Where's the turtle? Are you drawing or not drawing? And how are you pointing? Okay. Those are minimized, or else they're easy to see. Sometimes we write a lot of code. If we're not running the code, we're just kind of looking at the code, and then you kind of have to imagine what it would look like. And then there's syntax and naming. Poor names can really make a program unusable. I gave the example of how we say fill. Fill doesn't fill anything. Right? It just sets a fill caller. Well, why is it named so bad? And then there's syntax. I mean, sometimes you look at programming text and you can't even make any sense out of it. And sometimes, if you ever looked at HyperCard, it reads like English. Just give examples later. Anyway, so let's hit these five topics really fast and get into some languages. So what are good metaphors? Turtles are good metaphors. Stacks of cards, players that you can move, anything you can feel, touch, and stuff like that are good. And Smalltalk gave us what's now become known as... Okay, so what came out of Xerox PARC? Not only the personal computer, the Windows, the mice, the pointers, all that interactive and good graphics and stuff like that. Another thing that came out of there was this idea of object-oriented programming. Have you heard that term before? God, it was so big in the 1980s. Everything would be, look, I'm an object-oriented programming language. I am so awesome. Right. Was it a fad? Remember all the fads, computing fads, they come and go, right? Do we still have object-oriented programming? Yeah, what does that tell us? It's right. But what's right about it? What's right about it is that objects are self-contained. They have their own internal state behavior. They're encapsulated. They don't mess around with other objects except through crisply defined interfaces and all that stuff they like to teach you about academically. They work. They're a good metaphor. You know? Is the universe made out of fundamental processes? Oh, like reversal. Oh, yeah, there's this fundamental process called reversal or fundamental process called addition. No, we have numbers that can be added, and we have text strings that can be reversed. We tend to think of things and objects that have behaviors, not fundamental processes that operate on data. So this is why before object-oriented programming, we wrote all these functions, and we passed the data from this function. The function did some of the data and sent it over there, but hey, where's the house? Where's the person? Right? Where's the path? Where's the tree? Object-oriented programming helped us to think about that. Now, if there's any part of a fad about it, it was like every part of computation has to be object-oriented. And sometimes it went a little bit too far. And then if your first programming language is Java, and I hope that really wasn't your case, or C++ or something like really big and object-oriented, with languages like Java and C++, although they were object-oriented languages, you could see their heritage of the non-object-oriented parts just shine right through. I mean, you had to really work hard to get those objects in there. But Smalltalk had the objects from the beginning, and it was easier to learn for that reason. Decomposition. When you break a program down into things called modules or functions or objects, that kind of works. All those things are self-contained. Those are technical terms. You don't need to know them, but they are the high-level units of programming that are self-contained. The programmers have to think about. So if I'm making, say, a game, and the game has players, and players can pick up things, and players can do things to other players, and what else do they do with games right now? I don't know. Well, they move around. We talk about the players moving. We don't talk about, hey, I'm going to move the player. No, don't say you're going to move the player, because you can move the player, and you can move the thing. Moving is not what you should be thinking about. You should be thinking about how the player behaves, and how the objects behave. You think about it in terms of objects. And so when you have certain programming languages, they have these event handlers, so they have this idea of moving. So you look at the move event handler. I've got a move request here. So, okay, what am I moving? If I'm moving a person, do this. If I'm moving a thing, do that. And then there's other code over here that says, okay, for hiding. Well, this is the way I hide the player. This is the way I hide the thing. You have the idea of what a person is spread all throughout the code. Code that's built with these event handlers right there, you no longer identify with all of the things in your computation. And here's another example with objects. Remember that code that drew a circle by saying, what was it, or ellipse. You say ellipse, and you give it some values, and you know what that does? That draws the ellipse, and then the computation moves on. Okay, so let's say I'm a programmer, and I draw an ellipse using that programming language we saw earlier that Khan Academy talks about, and you draw your ellipse. How do you actually move the ellipse somewhere else? That would be a good thing, but in the language that they had there, you had to go back into the code and you had to change those numbers. You can't just pick it up and drag it. You can't say ellipse.move or something, right? You can't pick it. So how do you do animations? How do we make a bouncing ball? Can you imagine doing a bouncing ball animation if you had to type something in with loops and dots and things like that? I mean, if you don't have the notion of a standalone object, which you can say, set this position here, it's not going to work. The way you have to do it in this processing language is you have to draw, then you have to erase the screen, and then you have to draw. It's not right. Right? So these are called barriers to learning. Recomposition. Remember I suggested you look at two things from Brett Victor, his Inventing on Principle video and his Learnable Programming text. I'll get this thing online, this talk. I haven't put it online yet, but then I'll give you links to it. He talks to another guy named Larry Tesler, whose principle was that people should be free of working in certain modes when they program. And what we mean by a mode is illustrated really nicely by this thing at the bottom, I think. There's a little bit of code that's attempting to draw a flower, and the idea is you want to draw a green stem, green leaves, and a red flower. Pardon me. So here's some code right there. It says, I'm going to be in the green coloring mode right now, and I'm going to draw my stem, and then I'm going to draw some flowers. Okay? See what I said? Let's go into the green coloring mode so that everything I draw from now on is going to be green. And I draw the green stem. I didn't say draw a green stem and draw green leaves, because no, that would have been too correct. Right? That I have to be in the green mode, then I have to draw, then I have to draw. So someone over here in the middle says, I'm going to draw a red, whatever that thing is. And you can look at how horrible the code looks with all those numbers if you can see it. but it works. So go to the red drawing state. Now draw all my triangles around here to make it work, okay? So, ooh, let's put them together now. He puts it right in the middle there, and because you're in a mode, a stateful way of thinking, you put it in there, and your leaves turned red because you didn't say the red or the green leaf is an object. See, this is wrong. And it's stuff like this that makes programming hard. I'm sure a lot of people would start drawing and say, "Damn it, I can't. What happened? Why did it do this? Why did the computer do it?" And if you say that's just the way it is, you're not helping the learner, right? The thing is, there's like a moral wrong here. This is not the way we should program. You should not be in a state where you have to be in modes. This guy, Larry Tesler, he also was a big driving force at Xerox PARC, where all these ideas came from. That's his license plate, no modes. Free people from multiple. You don't get yourself into a state, and everything you do is dependent on that stuff. You should be freed from that kind of thinking. A little bit about syntax. This is not supposed to be technical. This is supposed to be somewhat easy to understand. I want to show you what I put in green, which are good things for a programming language to have. If I want to draw a circle, look at the top line in the green and then the top line in the red section. You're going to ask the question at the bottom, what did those numbers mean? Now, I know I did not answer the question, what units are they in? Okay, this isn't perfect or anything, right? But what do 2, 5, and 10 mean? Is 2 the radius? Now look at the top. Do you know what the numbers mean? Yes, you know what the numbers mean. What language is that top line written in? Anybody know? It's a famous language, starts with a P. Have you heard of Python? No, okay. Python's a language a lot of people love Python. Once you start Python, you'll love Python. Python is huge in the business right now. It's huge at Google. It's huge at all the big companies. It's huge at the startups because it makes sense. The second line is Objective-C. It's the language the iPhone programs are written in. Slightly different syntax, but the name of the operation is called draw circle centered at with radius. A very long name. Yes, in the 1950s, we couldn't afford long names. We didn't have enough memory to store long names. And it was very expensive to have a keystroke, you know, because we had to pay for that computer time. But I can understand it. I know what that's going to do. The third line is a list or an array of three numbers. I don't know what you're going to use it for, but hey, a list of numbers is something that, just take it for granted, they show up a lot in programming. It's really nice to write something like that. Okay, who's a good Java programmer right now, or a C programmer? Java or C? Oh, okay, different eyes. Well, that's fine. You wish you could write something that simple. No, the syntax doesn't support it. It's kind of hard to believe that a language and same thing happens with C. How do you make a list of numbers in C that I can pick up and move somewhere else? I can't. Show me a programmer that programs in Python or any modern language and tell them they have to program in C. They're going to lose their lunch. I can't describe simple little lists of numbers. Now, what's the fourth line? It's a description of apparently a dog, a five-year-old. Does that look like a five-year-old German shepherd named Rex? Sure does. How do you do? You know how to do that in Java? Oh God! You make a class, dog, private string breed, private int age, this thing, and then you make a constructor, and you make getters and setters and all this crap, and then you say new dog, Rex G-Shep 5. And when you make that new dog, do you know which one is the name and which one is the breed and which one is the age? Only by looking back at the definition of dogs to see which ones go first, second, and third. You know? This is real. This is Java. And don't even try to write it in C. Well, I mean, you can. You can make a struct. But that string, G-Shep of variable length, well, those get tricky. Oh, and if you allocate, you better remember to release the memory when you're done with that string. Okay. Some names. Oh. Let's make a vector. Okay, so anybody in engineering know what a vector is? Here's point. Vector goes from one to the other. Okay. I can tell at the top suppose I said vector, and they gave you two variables like x and y. Okay. Now, what are those two x and y's? And does the vector go from the origin to the point x, y? Or are those two points that the vector goes between? Or are those two vectors that you're going to add up to make another vector? If I see the word vector, and I see an x and a y, I don't know what those x and y, I don't know what it means. All right? Well, look at the top. If I say vector from start point and end point, that's the kind of library you want to work with. Or even vector from two in Objective C talk. But look at some of the problems at the bottom with JavaScript and processing. If you're going to set a fill color, you should call it set fill color. Rectangle by itself has no indication that you're drawing it, outlining it, filling it in, or simply declaring that one exists. Call it draw rectangle at least. Concat. That's a technical term. It shows up in a lot of languages. What does it mean? If you say no idea, that's fine. I wouldn't expect you to. I wouldn't expect anybody to know what concat was unless they were introduced to the magic of computer programming or something like that. No, it's ambiguous. But if you say array from two arrays or something, it might make sense. So anyway, this is a big list of things that Victor identified that you can read about. Independent modules, the ambiguity, are the parts of speech used right, you know, can we build it, and then things can be learnable. Now, this isn't an audience that probably wants to learn six new languages, but I thought you might like to know a little bit about these six languages, so it's okay that we only have about 10 minutes left. And the languages I'm going to talk about today, I want to talk about these languages just to see, these are relatively new, they've all come out in the last few years. And let's see if they've actually tried to make learning a priority or not. What's the language in the upper left? What's that picture? Anybody ever watch the Apple talks, the Apple Developers Conference, when Steve Jobs used to walk around? That language is Swift. Swift is the new language for the iPhones and the whole Apple. Apple's new thing. Apple's been on Objective-C for a long time. Now it's Swift. The R is for Rust. Rust is being created by Mozilla. Mozilla, you know them? Foundation. Yeah, their CEO stepped down last year, didn't he, or a few months ago. CEO of Mozilla had to step down. They found out that he was the creator of JavaScript, so he had to leave. Okay, I think only about half of you got that. But look him up. Brendan Eich is his name. He did create JavaScript. Julia. Okay, anyone heard of a language called MATLAB? Anyone in engineering? Engineers have a language called MATLAB. And with MATLAB, what you do is you can, like, directly multiply matrices and stuff. You can do all these amazing. It looks just like math. It's really tight. It's really funny to see a programmer that's only done C, and they write, like, 500 lines of C, and then they said, oh, you know, it's only about 4 or 5 lines of MATLAB. Like, wow, this is like really cool. Because they have powerful combining forms. The problem with a language like C is that C was designed for a particular purpose. To control a machine, to help me build an operating system that will control it. C is a systems programming language. When we talk about system languages and application languages, system languages control the machine. In C, you have to ask for memory when you need it, and give the memory back when you don't need it. You're thinking of memory. When I'm writing a game, I hope a library would do that for me. Yes. You are able to write a compiler for any language you want. Yes. Almost all languages have some compilers. Even languages which are interpreted, they're first compiled. It's just all wrapped inside. But yes, they all have compilers. Clojure is the bottom left. what's that one in the middle? It's called CoffeeScript. And the little gopher there is the mascot for the language Go, which is created by Google, and it's created in 2009, but is now really starting to pick up. You might see a lot of it later. So I didn't know how many programmers would be here today, but if there are programmers here, and you've ever written for I, you've ever seen that for I, that is like so archaic. Why the hell are you using for I want to go through and you know what? I have a list of things to do today. I want to do this and this and this and this. You tell this to programmers that have been around, like, oh yeah, for I, the hell is I? Oh, I is the number, zero, then one, then... Why do I give a crap about what number it's at? I just want to do everything. I want to think about lists as lists. I don't want to think about them as memory cells that have little addresses, 0, 1, 2. That's not the right way to think. And if you think about that, you're not going to be able to write big, useful programs for people. Destructuring is too advanced. Avoiding loops. Programming. You heard of loops? Programming has loops. But you know what? When you write your code without loops, they get shorter and they get easier to understand. How do you write a program without loops? You write operations that know how to work on big structures. To multi-line strings. Ooh, see the XY equals YX? If you're a programmer, it's only really for the programmers over here. You might have heard of swapping two variables. That's really like hard to do. But languages these days make it easy. There's another line there showing you like some slices. So anyway, here's an example of what you may see in a modern programming language. The top line is, make every dog in the kennel bark. There's some funny syntax around there, you know. That's Python code for making them all bark. I don't care what number the dog is. But if I wrote this in Java prior to Java 1.5, when people actually understood how to do Java, I cannot write that in C. I have to in C. I need to know the number of the dog. So that means you can't use it. And can libraries help? Somebody asked me earlier, can we just use C and get a good library? If you're a C programmer and you need to iterate through an array, you either increment pointers to go through them, don't even get me started on those, or you take I is 0, I is 1, I is 2, I is 3, and you index by the I. A library cannot help you with that. It has to be built into the language, the idea that as you iterate through a list or something, that it's the value in the list that matters, not its number. I can't see a library helping with that. If you find one out, let me know. We'll talk. Okay. The last three are just ways where you might take a list of values and just square the odd ones. Think about that problem. I have a list of numbers and I need the squares of the odd ones. I know it's all mathematical and stuff like that. But the point I'm trying to make here is the human being says, I want the odd number squared, just the odd number squared. Okay. There is a way to write in conventional C or C++-like programming with lots of loops and if statements, but I want the sum of n times n, where n is in my list of numbers, where it's... Well, that's actually wrong. See how easy it is to make typos? That should have said not equals zero, not equals zero. And then there are other techniques to do it, but techniques that don't ever write the loop. I mean, look at sum. Give me a list and I'll sum them up. You know, that's what you want to have. So here's a quick language. We just have I'll go a couple minutes over. In CoffeeScript, we can have our things like if can appear right in the middle of an expression. We don't need a big if block. We can make lists very easily and functions very easily, and we can talk about objects that have components pretty easily. In Clojure, you can write programs that would be tens of lines in other languages in one. We can scramble all of the letters of a string together simply by taking a string. Okay, that's that S. Turning it into a sequence, shuffling the sequence and joining them back together. We're using words that we kind of understand. Now, I'm not saying that anybody can pick this up in a day. That's not what I'm saying. But you pick it up faster than somewhere else. Here's a good one. Have you heard of C++? It's known as being one of the biggest, most gigantic languages designed by a committee, the whole bit. It gets bigger and bigger. Designed in 84, standardized in 1998. There was a C++ 11 came out, and Rob Pike, who designed C and works at Google, said, oh, we were sitting at Google and they told us these people were going to come in and tell us about all the new features and the new version of C++, already known and loathed as one of the biggest, most massive, hard-to-understand programming languages out there. You know, they upgraded the language by adding, you know, 35 features out of, you know, hundreds or something that they really did. They were going to talk about 35. Oh, yeah. That's the problem with C++. You lacked features. That motivated him and his friends to write a programming language called Go, which threw away a good portion of what was already even in C, not to mention C++, to come up with a really nice language. Rust is from Mozilla, and it's supposed to be fast, and it's supposed to be a language. Okay, here, the programming language C, programmers make all kinds of mistakes in it. Rust tries to prevent you from making mistakes. So Rust is an example of a language that is not really good for learners. Rust, they specifically said, we're not trying to teach people how to program. We're trying to help people write really complicated programs, but have a lot of safeguards in them. It's kind of like Ada, you know, in the old days. Ada had a lot of safeguards, so I don't know why that never came out. That was actually a really good language. It has some nice features in modern languages, but they didn't say they made it for learners. Julia, on the other hand, is kind of like MATLAB. You can take a big, complicated thing and just say, I want just this slice, I want this portion of the matrix, and it's very concise. It's very terse, and it's designed not necessarily for learning programs, it's designed for mathematicians. And then there's Swift, for which Apple did a pretty good job at, and I gave one example of Swift code over there. Increment by 5 3 times. You see how parts of what you're doing, parts of your parameters actually show up in the code? Now, this is nice. Now this is where modern languages can concede. So it's like if there's nothing else you can do, if you're designing a programming language, make it so that when you want to do something, or call a function, you say, what do all those numbers mean? Say what those numbers mean. Okay? This is a big list of things that Swift has, but again, this isn't a technical talk. I just want to press upon you that the people at Apple really thought about that. All right, let's wrap up. So if people were to ask you, oh, I want to learn programming. Should I learn a modern language or a traditional one? All these languages have popped up and they all have these nice new features. What they do all have in common is that you can sit down and go to a playground or an environment. They all, 6 of them, support nice little interactive playgrounds to help you get code up and see it as you go. That's been taken care of. That's kind of understood. They have programming features, so you don't have to say for I, you know, we don't do that anymore. But they're all industrial strength. So, you know, to say learning programming, you can say, well, I want to learn just a part of a language so I can do little things. That's different from saying I want to learn everything there is to know about these programming languages, because all 6 of those are all industrial strength. It's fine. You can learn just a part of a language and do little things. The danger of not learning everything, though, is that you're going to accidentally run into a feature of the language that's going to really trip you up. So when a language is really, really big, does that make it a good language for learning? I don't know. You've got to learn it sometime. But you can't get tripped up. So here's something interesting. I said Rust was not designed for learning. 7 types of pointers. Anybody know what a pointer is? Have you heard about pointers? Okay, if you haven't heard about pointers, pointers are an aspect of programming that is known to be really, really hard and really, really error-prone. Beginners don't want to learn 7 types of those things. All right, so decades of research on learning has been ignored by most programming languages, sometimes purposefully ignored. Live coding. Someone says, hey, go to Khan Academy, look, because as you type, you can see what. That's only one part of learning. The language is another part. Look for languages with good metaphors that help you think about things, that don't say fill and rect when they really shouldn't. And I just introduced you. I gave you the names of 6 new languages, so they're all industrial strength. They're not particularly geared toward learning, but they have features which are a little more convenient to a learner. And that's it. Nice. Good. Well, thanks. You guys want to discuss questions, anything?
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Modern languages tend to be a little bit better with structure. I think a good example is old languages like C, and I guess I say Fortran and this thing too. They're still a little more designed toward the machine. You should pick any language that helps you think in high-level concepts and doesn't restrict you. So when you say structure, yes, I did say that modern languages tend to let you avoid loops if you don't need them. I think the jury's out on that one. There's some people that say that's actually a good thing because learning about loops can get in the way. And they would like you to say, why don't you translate your thoughts into programs using a high-level language first, then learn about the machine later. It's like right now, if you can go both ways. You can start high and go low, or you can go low and start high. Nobody really starts the machine language anymore. They don't even start with assembly language. It's good to start in the middle and work out. Where the middle is for you, that's going to vary from person to person. So, answer to your question? Maybe. Hi, Bob. In high school? Unfortunately, they're using Java and C++ because that's what's on the AP exam, and that's what they're supposed to teach.
How about games?
Well, some high schools will have workshops and laboratories where you will be able to use Objective-C to write iOS games, or Objective-C. Yeah, that's for the iPhone. And or Java for Android, or that if they do. No AP class is going to teach, you know, writing apps for mobile, because they have to teach Java and C++ because that's what's on the AP exams. Yeah. No. Now, it's possible to design a language to say, hey, everybody, this is my language, and have somebody else write the compiler. However, it's a good idea to write the language and the compiler at the same time, because if you have the compiler, you can show people that, yeah, my language is worthwhile. I just didn't make it up out of my head. Yeah. Oh, the answer to that question is usually written as Java is to JavaScript as car is to carpet. They're nothing alike. Java is for industrial strength server side. JavaScript is mostly, but not exclusively, the language that runs inside the browser. JavaScript is a functional programming language. It tends to be pretty terse. Java is wholly object-oriented, very industrial strength. So JavaScript's just kind of like, you don't have to specify types. It's just kind of, you just kind of get the code out there. That said, there are ways to do JavaScript industrial strength these days.
So,
very different.
So if you just
you can write JavaScript with just inside your browser. Most web browsers today have a little menu item called Developer Tools. If you click that, you get a little thing that says start typing in your JavaScript.
Right. And then it will run. I wasn't planning on doing it. I was just trying to have enough on my computer so it can read web.
All you need is a web browser, yeah. If you have a web browser, you can write JavaScript. And you can do, and you can start by opening up their developer consoles and see a little prompt, say 2 + 2, and it will say 4. There's your program. And then you can do your fours and your ifs and your all that other stuff, too.
I want to look at your program. You may not be available.
Yeah. Or write your code very readably so the comments aren't necessary. And if you think that's not possible... okay. I'd be happy to debate you on that. There is a school of thought by one of the biggest proponents of this is Uncle Bob Martin. He's been programming for 50 years or so. He treats himself as someone who's amassed all this knowledge, and he's very good. He says, I'll try and quote him, treat every comment that you write as an admission that you failed to write readable code. Think that way. No, wait. No, hey. Just think about it. Write code that you can't read. Look at the comment that you wrote. Take the words in your comment. Name your function what you said in the comment. Okay? It will work. And when you start adopting this way of like, you will still need some comments. You will need some. Comments sometimes need to give a big intent. You cannot have a function name that tells you why I wrote this big application or what it does. because that needs to be commented. Copyright notices, not going to put that in your code, right? But you cannot use comment. I'm not saying don't write any comment. I'm just saying that a comment that you write must be something that cannot be said in the code, right?
Okay.
You would be surprised, you know, just write, make your code. You can do it.